Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Howdy, Dunkers. Hope your day is going well. Hope your day is full of love, joy, and everything that's gleeful in life. It's time for us to talk about basketball.
What in the SpongeBob I'm Normal was that intro? What the? Replace Steve with Steven. What is this?
I mean, that is my full name.
PH. There we go. Please, the PH. It kills me every time I see someone hit you with the full name. And it's like, that's not actually the, you know, that's fine. That's just years of knowing you. That is A-okay. I have my own name-related trauma, and I think I just project that when I see people mess up yours. But that's okay. That's another podcast for another day. We are here to talk some hoop. The All-Star break is here. As we're recording on a Friday morning, happy Valentine's Day to those celebrating, etc. Hope your day and weekend is filled with love, if that is what you want. Also, a bit of bookkeeping. Since I didn't do this last year because my brain was all over the place, obviously, Steve, I'm going to talk to you, Steve, on Monday, but heading into the weekend, Steve has a birthday coming up on Monday, so if you want to shoot him a happy birthday message on Monday, go ahead and do that. We'll give you the early reminder now so you can do that when the day comes. But just a quick early happy birthday to my guy. I really appreciate him. I'll do the full thing on Monday, but I want to get that out the way. Today's show, however, going to be a smooth one, going to be a chill one. We're going to go over some news. We're going to talk about the Unrivaled 101 tournament that caps off later tonight. Talk about what we've seen so far, what we project to happen later tonight as we have the semifinals and the finals. And then we will tap into the Dunker Spot mailbag, which we were supposed to do this a while ago, but because we had so much to talk about, it just became a, hey, let's push this back a little bit thing. And so now we're here as we enter the All-Star break. So we will be answering some of your questions. An early thank you to those who sent in questions. And as always, if you have basketball thoughts of any kind, really, you can always shoot us an email at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. As for the news, oh, were you about to say something, Steve?
I don't have the password.
There's no way you don't have the... That also is another podcast episode. It may be worth an actual podcast episode. This man has received the password like 8 different times at this point and just does not have it somehow. And then, you know, it's okay. It is okay. We are going to operate in love today. And I am sure as we transition that Brandon Ingram loves what will be entering his bank account over the next 3 years. The Raptors and Brandon Ingram agreeing to a 3-year, $120 million extension, a player option for year 3. So still waiting on the Brandon Ingram experience to kick off in earnest in Toronto, but they make the trade for him. They lock him down for at least the next 2 years, and we see what happens with the player option. But the Raptors have a pretty prolific scorer in their backyard for at least the next 2 seasons. So quick salute to the Raptors and Brandon Ingram there. As we kind of teased on the last episode of the podcast, Alex Len released, was expected to join the Indiana Pacers. And then we got the reporting that he would not be joining the Pacers. Kind of guessed that in light of the Lakers trade falling through with Mark Williams, that he may end up being a Laker. And sure enough, Alex Len is indeed a Los Angeles Laker, made his debut against the Utah Jazz, 4.7 rebounds and a block in 22 minutes. So Alex Len is now a Laker. The Kings making a move of their own. They signed Markelle Fultz to a deal to bolster up the point guard room. The Sixers converting Jared Butler's two-way deal into a standard 2-year contract. Jared Butler averaging 10 points and around 5 assists in 3 games with Philadelphia so far. And on the downside, we have Daniel Gafford. We have yet another front court injury for the Dallas Mavericks. But Daniel Gafford expected to miss at least 6 weeks with an MCL sprain. Gafford having himself a quality year so far. A career-high 12.9 points per game, converting 70% of his twos, 7 boards, nearly 3 offensive rebounds, and almost 2 blocks per game. He has been a prolific shot blocker, lob threat, roamer in the dunker spot for Dallas. And, buddy, without Gafford, without Lively, without Anthony Davis, Dallas is going to trend pretty small for a little bit.
It's small ball time, baby.
It sure is.
It's Omax time. It's Najee Marshall time. It continues to be Max Christie time.
I would like for Dallas to just switch and commit to switching instead of just putting 2 on the ball when you're small. That's just a pet peeve of mine personally, because why are you doing that? Hey, they're going to be small. They have an identity. They're going to have to scrap and work on defense. And yeah, hey, there's enough shots to go around.
There sure are. But to your point, I love that the two on the ball when going small things a pet peeve for you. That is also a thing that catches my eye. But in general, man, I just want Dallas to get healthy. Like, it just kind of stinks that we had the full-blown trade conversation. You can listen to that episode of Dunker Spot if you'd like. But to have this vision of size and versatility to just shrink the floor against teams and also just bully them on the other end, and then all of your forwards and centers, sans Najee Marshall and Omax and a little bit of Kyler Kelly, is everybody hurt? It just kind of stinks from a basketball perspective. I would like for them to, at the very least, get an extended look at what they want their vision to be. And we're just not going to get that for a while. And in light of how tough the Western Conference is and what the standings are looking like heading into the break, I don't know how much Dallas can afford. It doesn't feel like they have a lot of leeway as they wait for some of their big man room to get healthy. They're currently the 8th seed as of recording, a game and a half ahead of Sacramento for 9, a game and a half ahead of Golden State at 10. Phoenix is 11. They're a game and a half behind Golden State. But, I mean, any kind of losing streak for Dallas puts them in jeopardy of sliding out of the play-in right now. So we'll certainly keep an eye on that moving post-All-Star break.
Hey, guys, going into the All-Star break, what streak is Dallas on?
They're on a 2-game winning streak.
All right, perfect. Just wanted to acknowledge that.
That's fair. That's fair. So if they can keep it going, and you know, if they can face Miami's offense more often, then they may not have to worry about sliding out of the play-in. But that's okay.
Wow.
Hey, listen, I have bones to pick. We're not going to do that today. We, again, are operating in love.
I have a question.
What's up?
Have we talked about the All-Star game or All-Star weekend?
We sure haven't. Outside of these are the participants and these are some of the replacements, et cetera. So are you excited for this weekend's All-Star festivities, Steve?
I thought the draft they did was a tremendous bit where they basically... Mm-hmm. Went team international against team veteran against team young guys, mm-hmm. which I thought was fascinating because, look, they got me. They got me on that bit. Was it a WWE draft? Sure. But I was all in because, like, hey, this might work competition-wise. Hey, y'all over there, y'all over there, y'all over there. And if y'all don't want to play, the Rising Stars will try their best.
You better come ready or you're going to get played off the court.
So if you don't want to hoop, your whole group is going to leave. You will lose and that will be it. So I'm intrigued to see what it looks like. Obviously, we got some injury subs, so things will change a little bit. But I'm intrigued by that. Okay. I want to see if that taps the competitive button just a little bit. I'm intrigued by I always love All-Star Saturday. Surprised you haven't had any Rising Stars thoughts. Usually every year there's one team that puts together. It's like, boy, no one can score on this team, or you know what I mean? Something like that is said. So I was a little surprised by that. Mm-hmm. We got the celebrity game. Bailey, the MVP. Or I will write. Let's see. The skills competition. I'm just letting you know. I'm going with Victor Wembanyama's team. Because that man was upset.
Hey, let's say we got is not Wimby and Chris Paul.
Yeah,
it's just psychos, complimentary, but just psychos. I am also hitching my wagon. But to your point about the Rising Stars, Team Mitch is absolutely my "how the heck did y'all let this happen?" Referring to the other coaches, because listen to some of the names here on Team Mitch: Tumani Kamara, Bilal Coulibaly, Eve Missy, Amen Thompson, Asar Thompson. Now, Scoot's been injured. He's been replaced. But, like, they have so much defense on their roster.
Is this Bub Carrington erasure?
It's not, because Bub has also shown some really fun flashes this year for Washington. But I was going more so, he's not known for the defense. He has certainly played his tail off from their perspective. I think he's been better defensively than I anticipated, just based on, like, the archetype. Because, again, I'm not a draft person. So, like, I didn't have priors on Bub. And so, from what I saw in Summer League, I was like, okay, this is going to be a bucket getter. He's going to try to play make, et cetera. I've been impressed with how hard he's played defensively. But, like, the other guys I've named, they kind of make their hay on that end. Or at least that's what pops the most. So, I didn't mean to disrespect Bub. But that's why I went there first.
I think it would be a very funny bit if they played at full strength and played defense and defended their way to Sunday and ended up winning everything. Here's the problem, Nick Ayers.
What's up?
There is no guarantee that defense will actually show up and be played. How are they going to score? I mean, they're athletic. They got drivers, but I'm very curious.
Man, listen, everybody going to screen. Literally everybody's going to screen. It's going to screen. It's going to be a lot of driving. To your point, though, I am like mentally prepared for the, oh my God, they went 3-for-17 on threes and they got upset by team, insert team name here. But that's a lot of athleticism. That's a lot of defense. And if they do give like legitimate effort because they want to advance, that's going to be annoying to deal with. Because if you do get like loose shot selection on the other end, or just in general players just playing, it is an all-star format at the end of the day. If this just turns into turnover central, like I feel like Team Mitch is equipped and literally designed to take advantage of that kind of thing. So that is the team that I have my eye on the most heading into the into the competition.
Damian Lillard, three-peat, and I got Stephon Castle winning the slam dunk contest.
Okay. I like it. Oh, Stephon Castle dethroning Matt McClung.
Yeah.
Okay. I like it. We'll see if Tyler Hero gets the happy to be here. If Tyler Hero redeems some of this recent Heat play, gets a three-point contest win. It's kind of hard to bet against Matt McClung because that man is just absurd. But I would love to see a Stephon Castle win for sure. I'm honestly curious to see what Matas Buzelis looks like in this competition. Powerful dunker. I know he's going to bring out some wild stuff, but we'll see if he actually converts.
And my all-star pick is the OGs.
Of course. Hey, listen. So here's the thing with the OGs, right? What if they're just like, hey, we don't really feel like it. We don't like this format like that. We've had to do 87 different events. You get LeBron. I've been asked 87 times if this is my last one and all of the things. And they're just like, you know what? We're kind of over it by the time Sunday gets here. Are you prepared for that possibility?
Nope.
Ah, well, you are now.
So who are you picking then, Nikias? Let me guess, the young star, the global stars?
I mean, yes. I mean, like, that is so much, like, we can be so honest, man. That's so much size. Like, I feel like this is the all-star team that I would attempt to put together. Here's Point Shay. Here's Giannis at the darn three, if you want to. Like, yes, absolutely.
Man, yeah, you would put that together, but the young star speaks to your heart. Don't lie to me.
Hey, listen, I hope they do well.
You made a case for every single one of them. An all-star. What do you mean?
And they made it. But
you spent 2 months on this podcast saying Jalen Williams is better than LeBron James.
Having a better season. Let's not hold on now. But I'm happy he made it. You know what I mean? I was a little bit surprised. Again, we did the coaches' predictions ahead of the reserves being named, and I thought Jalen Williams was going to be out in favor of Sabonis and Jaren and Şengün. And then they were just like, actually, we don't want Sabonis in there. It's like, okay, not what I had on the bingo card, but salute to Jalen Williams. So hope he performs well. Hope he has the jumper going. But if you're just asking me who I think is going to win, I would be very surprised if the Global All-Stars don't get that done. Like, that's, again, that is a lot of talent, first and foremost, but they are incredibly tall and lengthy and talented at the same time. Like, I think if they actually care, like, they just pose so many matchup problems up and down the floor, it's going to be kind of tough to deal with.
Would be very funny if the OGs just got ran off the court by the Rising Stars, but it is set up for them not to get run off the court by the Rising Stars.
Mm. Hey, listen. What if they just win the whole thing?
Chaos.
Oh, man. We come back on the pod next week like, yo, what did we witness? Would be incredibly fun. But okay, any more All-Star thoughts before we move?
No, just wanted to get those in there real quick. We can get back to the regular scheduled programming.
No, I like it. On the W side, the Storm getting busy. Signing Erica Willer, Zaya Cook, and Breonna Fraser to training camp deals, essentially whatever their equivalent minimum contract is. And Mackenzie Holmes, who was out with injury last year, officially signs her rookie-scale contract. So the Storm adding some depth pieces, at least for now. And related to the Storm, former Storm center, Mercedes Russell, signing with the Los Angeles Sparks, a one-year, $160,000 contract. Any surprises or any thoughts between the Erica Wheeler and Mercedes Russell signings in particular?
Not particularly. I mean, I think if you look at the Sparks roster, you're hoping for depth, letting Cam Brink take her time to properly come back. So it makes sense. Get a veteran presence, especially in a team that is looking to win now. We saw that in the Kelsey Plum presser. We're going to hoop. Kelsey Plum meant that. So I get that. And I think for Seattle, getting Erica Wheeler fits with what they want to do. Try and solidify that bench and make sure they have kind of some playmaking experience throughout the lineup. So no qualms there. What about you?
I like it. Like, I think the Mercedes Russell one, like, the price surprised me a little bit, but ultimately the Sparks adding that kind of front court depth, as you mentioned, Cam Brink still recovering, it makes a lot of sense. Mercedes Russell was a quality defender last year. Very aggressive defense for Seattle. We talked about that throughout the season last year. They blitzed a ton. A lot of pressure put at point of screens by Ezi Matbagor and Neko Gumake. So I'm curious to see what Lynn Roberts wants to do defensively, just scheme-wise, with the Sparks. But Mercedes Russell is a scheme coverage big, so I think whatever they do ask her to do, she's going to do a quality job at it. The Sparks were, I think, 10th in defensive rating last year, so any kind of improvement they can have on that front, in addition to the firepower that Kelsey Plum is going to bring, provided she stays healthy, like, I think a smart depth signing, even if I was a little surprised by what the price point ended up being. As for Erica Wheeler, getting a quality vet in the room, getting someone that can get 2 feet in the paint, kind of sticks with the emphasis on drives that we saw from Seattle last year. So it makes sense to give Erica Wheeler the flyer on that front. I'm curious with these, with the training camp deals. Specifically, the Zaya Cook signing kind of caught the eye, because we saw flashes for her with the Sparks, wasn't able to completely put it together on both ends of the floor. You think scoring mentality wasn't the most efficient, but again, young guard in the W, it's going to take some time to get that together. So I am curious to see if this is legitimately a, let's get you into camp, see what it looks like and move forward, or if they are planning on investing in Zaya Cook and her being a part of replacing some of the scoring punch that you're going to be missing with Jewel Lloyd now being in Vegas. So I'm curious to see just what that ends up turning into. Obviously rooting for her to stick there, but that one caught the eye. But no, as for Wheeler and Russell, they're just adding a pair of vets to kind of fit into what these teams want to do and what they want to bolster up. So made sense from an on-court perspective at the very least.
Did you have any thoughts from the Kelsey Plum presser? Anything stand out to you at all?
How happy she was. It's kind of similar to the Jewel thing where you could just kind of see, you can kind of feel the joy and being in a new spot and also being prioritized and being valued. Like the quote that's making the rounds, and at least slightly unfairly so because of some of the narrative's taking it. But just Kelsey talking about how she's never been treated better since joining the Sparks and how her expectations have been exceeded based on some of the concerns that she had before joining the Sparks and stuff like that. Just felt more like the Sparks have done everything they could to kind of dispel some of these notions that are out there, more than like Kelsey throwing Vegas shade. Like, I didn't take it that way. But she seems ready to go. She immediately talked about the basketball fit. I got a good chuckle out of her as she was talking about the respect that she had for Lynn Roberts and what she was doing in Utah. And she made the point, like, she was essentially making the point that she was impressed by them always being super competitive, despite not having like a bunch of like 5-star recruits, stuff like that. But she said, you know, not to be rude, but like sub-level talent. I was like, darn. And like people start laughing. She's like, no, like, I'm not trying to be mean, but it's like, they don't have, again, like they're not getting like the UConn recruits and stuff like that, but they were still really good every year. So she was just impressed by how she was able to get those, she was able to coach those teams up is the point that she was making. But I did get a good chuckle out of that one. I know there's she didn't mean it like that, but
there's a joke here, but I'm not going to make it.
Ah. Oh, no, don't do that. I'd like to come back next week. You know, I'm very excited for, like, we're going to be doing watch parties all weekend. I'm very excited for, like, someone just pop in on Friday night. Like, Steve, I can't believe. Like, yeah, I can't believe it either. But there's your early Easter. I know. Gosh darn it. There's your Easter egg for the dirt pot. But no, she seems ready to go. She talked a lot about her relationship with De'Erica Hamby as a star, as an ace, and now they're back together again. So that part's cool. And like, obviously they have on-court chemistry built up from their time together. So I think that'd be a pretty seamless fit. Kelsey and pick and roll, Kelsey coming off a handoff. So they want to invert things for De'Erica, the off-ball stuff. Like, I think that's going to be natural two-player actions that the Sparks can get to quite a bit. So happy for KP. So hopefully things go well on that front, but cool presser overall.
Very cool.
There we go. All right. Well, related to the W, as how do we want to make this transition? KP was initially part of the unrivaled roster, and then it was like, oh, actually, I got a lot going on. And we later find out she's leaving Vegas and all the things. But let's talk a little unrivaled. We have the 1v1 competition that kicked off earlier this week. We had the semifinals later tonight. And the semifinals matchups are interesting. We have Aaliyah Edwards, Cinderella Run right now against Arike Ogunbowale. And then we have Azaree Stevens versus Nafisa Collier after that matchup. And then the finals, you know, whoever wins between those two matchups, it would be a best of three between the winners there. So before even getting into those specific matchups, Steve, what's been your overall impression of the one-on-one tournament as a concept? Do you like the 7-second shot clock? Do you like the being able to pass it out to a designator, entry passer and resetter and stuff like that? Just how have you felt about the format so far?
I liked it. It's been fun. It's been fun to watch. I mean, I think the shot clock can be challenging at times, but it is fun that, hey, you can pass, you can kind of get to your spot, you can make a quick decision, you got to go. I think the one thing you, as the tournament wore on, you know, early results were a little tricky. Because, I mean, again, it's going to 11. It's not win by two. And it's twos and threes, so this can get out of hand very quickly if someone is hot and making shots. But you kind of saw as it went on, competition ramped up, the strategy started to come in play. Oh, you're driving, I'm about to foul you. You don't get to do that. Oh, you're fouling me every drive? Well, I'm about to shoot and get a shooting foul, go to the free throw line. Not in love with some of these ending on free throws. Don't love that, but that's just me being old school. But you got, like, the mentality. One-on-one has its own process, even if some people think it's processless basketball, because you have to go out there and get it, and you got to figure out how to do it, and you got to do it in different ways. Got to get a bucket. Are you going to drive? Are you going to shoot? Is your shot going? Are you missing? Okay. Can I go back to my shot, or do I need to drive? If I drive that hard, how much gas do I have left in the tank? Oh, I got to stop. Long rebound. They got it back. Oh, no. You know, I thought the Courtney Williams matchup was very funny. His court came out ready to go. And then it was like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. Now you got to deal with all this. And then you had Arike and Skylar. That was very funny. Skylar was like, absolutely not. No drives for you. And Arike was like, fine.
Well, that drive was harder. I'll drive harder. You're not wrong, though. And just very quickly, because you mentioned like the rules things and some of the strategy that goes into it. I already have an tremendous amount of respect for Skylar Diggins-Smith. For her being the first player to recognize, like, oh, right, it's two fouls before you get this automatic point. Oh, bet. Oh, no, I'm beat. Hack, rap. Nah, go do that again. And then just physical defense and get stopped, and that she can go. It's like her immediately, like, hacking it sounds derogatory, but like her hacking the system early on and being the first person to really get into it. I was like, heading into the matchup, I knew she was going to take the one-on-one thing seriously because she's just a ridiculous competitor, complimentary. And to see her immediately go into that bag, like I made the joke during the watch party, it's like, this is just Chris Paulian to have the rules down to that degree to make sure I get every edge possible in this tournament to get a win. And so I really appreciated that portion of the program. But to the Arike matchup, yeah, that was a physical bout. And even to the Courtney Williams-Ryan Howard matchup, good gracious. The pregame talk, which shout out Ross Goldenwude, because she was trying her best to get like good stuff from the players. And like with that matchup in particular, you got very succinct trash talk, and that was just it. And I was like, oh, this might actually be a little bit more than we're anticipating. And the literal first, like Ryan Howard is like, oh, nah, court always talking, it's all right. Goes out to take the shot to get ball first, catches the three. I was like, oh, she is locked and loaded. Before Ryan gets the ball to start the first possession officially, Courtney Williams is in her grill. I was like, oh, this is going to be serious. I see. Drive, bump, layup attempt, big block that also probably could have been a foul. And I'm just like, oh, we got some real one-on-one here. probably my favorite matchup of the tournament so far. Those two just going at it.
I'm not going to lie. If I was the Washington Mystics and people were making fun of what I've done this offseason, I would just point to Ali Edwards. And be like, that's our offseason acquisition.
Yeah, we got to play her more.
Because, bud, he's... Respect bigs, by the way, Nikias. You didn't respect the bigs. Look at the semis.
Three bigs and Arike. It's pretty fire. Like, it was one of those things where, like, in a vacuum, like, Azaray Stevens, very good creator for a big. Like, I was just kind of worried about, hey, if she does miss, and now she has to defend in space against some of these guards, if she gets that matchup, what is that going to look like? With Shakira Austin's, like, very talented self-creator for a big, but, like, the finishing gets kind of questionable. And if she isn't able to get those finishes to go, what is that going to look like? I trust her on defense, but, like, what is that going to look like? So I just had some hesitation about what the bigs were going to look like in a 7-second shot clock format and then potentially being matched up with guards. But to your point, I have very much been proven wrong on this front. Like, you mentioned Aaliyah Edwards up front because she's in the semifinals. Shakira Austin kicked this thing off with, what, a 12-2 win over Chelsea Gray?
Yeah, you didn't see that coming.
I didn't have that. Especially since, with Chelsea specifically, she, you know, through the last 2 years of the Vegas run, if you want to zoom in on that portion, it's not like she hasn't had her fair share of minutes defending bigs. When the Aces go small and switch a bunch, like, she spent a bunch of time on Breanna Stewart in their matchups with the Liberty. So, like, even that made me feel better about Chelsea in this format. Like, tough shot maker, of course. But on the defensive end, if she is matched up against someone bigger, she just does that all the time already. So I wasn't super concerned about her in that kind of thing. And Shakira Austin just said, nah, I'm bigger than you. Here are these drives. Here are these post touches. If I miss, I'll get my own. I'm going to continue to use the glass. It was a really impressive win, and thorough, for that matter. So, I don't know. I will take the L on that front. The bigs really came through in this one.
Speaking of L's, Nafisa Collier has been handing out anyone who faces her in a brief and succinct L as quickly as possible, while just looking incredibly smooth and possessed to win this tournament.
Yeah. Listen. The Katie Lou Samuelson matchup to kick things off, because that started out either 6-0 or 8-0. And I was like, well, darn, Katie Lou. Like, you ain't even doing nothing wrong. Like, Fee's just getting to her spots and knocking down the short jumpers. Like, there isn't much you can really do with this. And then, you know, jumpers started getting missed. Katie Lou started to make a little bit of a run. I was like, huh, this might get interesting. Fee said, absolutely not. We are, no, actually, let's get this done. I would like to sit down for a little bit. No, we're not doing that. And then we get Rekia Jackson. And in the pregame, they were in that pregame conversation with Roz. Fee makes the note, like, I'm the best player here. I just got to play like it. I was like, oh, well, like, you are, but I wasn't expecting that from you with a smile. I was like, okay. And this is Rekia Jackson coming off the Jackie Young win, which, brief aside, I hope Jackie's all right, man. That is stressing me. That is stressing me. Like, she didn't start the unrivaled season dealing with a knee thing. And she plays, and she's immediately getting banged up on these drives. And it's like, all right, this is kind of tough. We get to the one-on-one tournament, and I think she gets hit in the face during the Rekia Jackson matchup. Very loud yell as it happens. She's on the court for a little bit. I'm just like, dog, I think I'm okay. I end up quote tweeting my own tweet from a while ago. I was like, I think I'm okay if I don't see any more Jackie in unrivaled this year. And this is purely, like, a health thought for me. Like, hey, please stop getting hit and hurt and laying on the floor for a long time. This is, as a basketball fan, this is very stressful.
I mean, it's just because you can see it.
Yeah.
This could happen at any point in the offseason.
That's like, you're like, logically, you're absolutely correct. Yeah. The visibility on top of it is just kind of like, hey.
Hey, real hoopers get it done.
And, you know, circling back, Nafisa Collier certainly did that, because she was very mean to Rekia Jackson in that matchup. Fee's just good, man. She is really good. She has just been the best player here throughout all of this. And I know we'll have a little bit more on that later in the pod. But as we get into the semifinals and potential finals matchups, Steve, who do you have? Who do you have getting to the finals, first and foremost?
I have Nafisa Collier getting to the finals. No disrespect to Azaree Stevens. I think that will be a fun matchup. But I got Fee getting there. The Aaliyah Edwards Arike one intrigues me because Aaliyah Edwards went ahead and said, "Ollie Chagre, nice to see you. I'm going to hit you as many times as I possibly can. And if you cut me off, I'm going to hit you and go the other way. And then I'm going to do it again. And then I'm going to do it again."
Yeah, Alicia didn't have fun in that one.
So that is interesting against Arike, who takes some of those blows. How many of those blows can Arike take? How many shots does Arike make? Mm-hmm. How many drives do we have? Like, I'm intrigued. Mm-hmm. I'm going Arike against Fee.
Boy, that is a superstar matchup, I tell you what. But I'm in a similar boat with you, man, as again, Aaliyah Edwards with a 12-0 victory over Breanna Stewart to kick this off, man. I, like, you know, full transparency, like, I did not have Aaliyah Edwards beating Breanna Stewart. Like, I thought this was going to be a deep run for Stewart. But even if you told me, hey, Nikaia Stewie is going to lose to Aaliyah Edwards, like, my initial thought would just be, like, this will be, like, an 8 or 9 minute game that ends, like, 12-9 because Stewie's missing a bunch of jumpers and she's making life tough on Aaliyah, and it just turns into like long rebound into drive fest to close things out. It would have been one of those. You couldn't have paid me enough to believe that it was going to be 12-0. And like, it was going to be not just that, but like quick work. And this is Aaliyah, take these sidestep threes against Stewie. And then, as you already mentioned, you get to Alicia Gray, like, okay, cool. This is someone that's smaller than me. I can now just bully you with these drives. And like, I honestly, maybe I should have put more stock into Aaliyah, because like, I've been doing power ranking stuff for Bleach Report on the Unrivaled front. And like the last 2-3 weeks, I've been writing about how good Aaliyah Edwards has looked off the bench and how comfortable she's looked as a creator and her sprinkling in these jumpers, et cetera. And so I should have kind of indexed, hey, she may perform better in this context than I'm giving her credit for because of how she's playing right now. And this has turned into a semifinals run against, again, like, I think Arike is a better player, but she is bigger than Arike. If Arike takes, and Arike is the higher seeded player, so I think she will still get to choose if she wants to take the shot to get ball first or whatever. If Arike wants to get ball first and she misses and Aaliyah Edwards starts with ball, this could just be a dry fest for Aaliyah Edwards. And now we're looking at her versus a big in the finals. I can't rule it out.
So are you picking Aaliyah Edwards, Nick Hayes?
I might ride the hot hand. I might ride the hot hand. I think Aaliyah Edwards continues to run. That would be my bold prediction on this here podcast.
Hey, Dunkers, can we add that to the Arike compilation?
That's crazy. That's nasty business from you, but that's all right.
I've got 4 minutes worth. We're good.
4 minutes worth. All right. I know what you are. I too am picking Nafisa Collier, though. I think Azaree Stevens will make this tough. I think we get the UConn battle in the finals.
Oh, brother.
In which case, it's hard for me to see anyone beating Fee twice as we get this deep into the tournament. I think Fee wins it, ultimately. But we should be in for some fun stuff.
I do like that the finals are best out of three. That's just a fun element. That adds to the mental game. Mm-hmm. So I'm intrigued to see how that works out.
Which, because just looking at the Unrivaled schedule, the finals will start at 8, then the second game is at 8:15, and then if there is a third game, it'd be at 8:30. And we're looking at, what, a 10-minute clock between these games. It doesn't feel like they get much of a break between these games. So I do wonder if it just turns into, like, you know, midway through game two, and then the game three, if it's there, who has the legs to make jumpers? It could get interesting. That is a lot to have to play a matchup early on to get to the finals. And then you got three games with the shortened shot clock and things like that without much of a break in between. So the best conditioned athletes going to have the edge in this one. I'm excited to see how it plays out. I think just kind of zooming out with the tournament that we can move forward. It does think that we had so many absences heading into the first round, like understandable stuff with injury, sickness, whatever case may be, prior engagements, whatever. So we didn't get the full breadth of the 1v1 bracket. But within that context, I still feel like this has been pretty fun. Like, I still like the concept.
No, I like the concept too. I wish we would have been able to get the full assortment, but hopefully everyone is healthy and good to go. I do appreciate Unrivaled. Just kind of scooting the bracket along. So if you somehow missed the first day, you just didn't know that these things happen. And so it just ran smoothly.
All right, round two. Here we go. Wait, who has a bye in round two? Doesn't matter. Games are happening. Woo, jump it up. But no, that part's fun. I think rules-wise, a couple of quibbles, I would say. I guess I wonder, as we get into year two of this thing, do we see the shot clock go from 7 to 10? Or it still is the full shot clock, but you got a little bit more room to work with? The other thing, I think in light of the shortened shot clock and stuff, it is kind of weird that you have to kind of check ball after literally everything. Like, there's probably a little room for it if player shoots an air ball, like, hey, why am I checking this? Or if I steal the ball, why do I then have to once again check this? Like, no, like, I just have the ball now since I only got 7 seconds to work with.
Nikias, let me introduce you to a concept.
Okay.
Ball up top.
I'm aware. I'm just saying, like, that plus the short shot clock is where I'm just like, hey, I would like one of the things to change. If you're keeping it at 7, then I want some leeway on like that kind of situation. Air ball shot, or like you are trying to post me up, I strip you. I should just be able to go straight up. Or if I block your shot, I should be able to go straight up. Or, like, again, extend it to, it doesn't even have to be like 14 or a full 24. Extend it to 10. Then I'm like, okay, fine. To check it up and everything, you still have the room to work with. That'd be like my only minor tweak that I would make on the rule front.
Nikias always tweaking on the rules. Whoa.
My swerve bend that corner. Okay. Without further, I guess before we move, any general Unrivaled thoughts you'd like to get off? We did have games last week, but we had a game cancellation because of injuries and stuff like that. But any thoughts moving ahead as we transition back into 3v3 play next week?
No, just excited to see how it continues to go. I will say, back to the 1-on-1 tournament, hey, if you wanted them people on the sides throwing them passes, please do a better job.
Let me throw the passes, bro.
How you gonna see the hand and throw a bounce pass that just goes under the hand? Like,
I'm so glad you said this. Just like, I think between that and like the players also not knowing in real time which person to pass it to, have gotten some chuckles out of me during this portion of the program. But yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you. It's just as far as a general 3-on-3 thought. When are the Lunar Owls going to lose? I think that's about all I got, honestly. It's that plus I want the Laces to get healthy. But, like, the Mist just flat out should have beat the Lunar Owls. And they got out of school. It was like 20-8 in the final quarter. It was just kind of absurd, bro. They've just been really good. Shout out Fee, shout out Skylar and Alicia and Courtney. And they've just been a buzzsaw throughout this entire tournament. Recently wrote about it. They're 8-0 right now. Half of those wins are by double digits. It's nuts what they've been able to put together. But okay, through the 1v1 portion / the Unrivaled portion, let's get into the mailbag. Once again, if you ever have basketball questions for us, NBA front, W front, Unrivaled front, Athletes Unlimited front, whatever the case may be, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. I guess I will get to them, as Steve has for the 8th time in a row lost the password. So we will get to those when we can. First one coming from Steven, again, a repeat caller, says, hey, Steve and Nikias, since you guys seem to have so much fun with the floater talk, I figured I'd lob you up another one. This time, I think it might be more in Steve's lane. Cavs Thunder helped crystallize a question that's been bouncing around my head for a while, which is, does NBA discourse consistently misunderstand the concept of spacing? Side note, based on the previous question he sent in, I felt pretty dumb wondering if floater volume was down across the league watching a game with Darius Garland and Isaiah Hartenstein on the floor at the same time. Don't do that. That's okay. But back to the question. a lot of media tend to describe spacing as being about having the maximum distance between players, with five out driving kick styles being seen as the epitome of good spacing. However, watching Evan Mobley rolling hard toward Jared Allen, the dunker salute, I realized that what Cleveland was doing on those possessions was clearly an example of elite spacing, even though having multiple bigs around the paint is often the example given when people talk about how spacing used to be bad. Could you talk a bit about how teams like Cleveland understand spacing and intentionally using tighter spacing in some situations as a way to bend the defense and dictate help? Also, does the current valorization of five-out spacing mean that fans and media undervalue the skill set of catching and finishing around the rim on rolls and cuts and overvalue the ability to get to the rim and finish on drives? Love the direction you guys took the last question, even though I was objectively wrong. So I'm hoping I can spark some fun conversation with this one, too. Thanks for doing what you do. You guys have really allowed me to actually understand what I'm watching when I'm watching games.
I think that it's very easy to think of spacing as shooting, especially when teams are kind of bending things in a different way where, okay, we're going to put one shooter on the wing and then we're going to leave the corner empty. And now we're going to try and bend your rotations that way. But I think you have to remember a key component of spacing is just putting pressure on a defense to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And I think the first example I'd point to that people may not consider or think about, Boston and their ability to kind of tweak things in a different way, where, you know, the way they ran that set, they run it all year, they ran it last year in the playoffs, we're going guard screen, or we're going guard, wing, screen, whoever, our big that can't shoot is on this right wing. Yeah, you're going to help off of him, but we're going to advance it to him, and now he's in action. Hmm. So while that spacing may not be a shot, that spacing now opens up the next action. And so we see that oftentimes, you know, teams will stash their big in the corner. It's like, okay, yeah, you're going to make that weak side rotation because that's automatic for you. But now that big's going to go right into a handoff. Mm-hmm. And now because you're that far away, how does that work for you? You know, we've seen where there's, you know, three guards on one side to a degree. It's all about who's where and what happens. You know, Jimmy Butler space in the corner might not sound like a great idea for Golden State. It looks a little bit different when Jimmy Butler recognizes what the defense is doing and now cuts to the block. And now someone fills his spot. Maybe he becomes a screener down there. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen teams historically put guards in the dunker spot. Sounds like a silly idea. Why is a small guy down there? Well, you know who's ends up being the rotator?
Another small guy.
The low man. So now, hey, they've got to make a decision they're not used to making, and the size isn't the same. So yeah. I think you just got to kind of be open-minded with what spacing means and what spacing is. And I think one thing I'd point to is just the amount of cuts you see now, where you're trying to clear certain areas of the floor. So the ball goes to the wing and I'm at the top. I want to get this nail defender out of here. Or I'm a shooter. I'm going to hold for a beat. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we put our shooter in different spots that we think you're going to make a decision on, but that opens up things for maybe the non-shooter, maybe the cutters. Like if you watch Milwaukee, Andre Jackson Jr. in that corner, as soon as you turn your back on him, he's gone. Mm-hmm. He's cutting. So I think, I don't know. I think misunderstand might be a little too strong, but I think it's just kind of going with the easy route of, well, they got shooting. Well, yeah, shooters are great. Don't get me wrong, but it's everyone kind of goes with terrible spacing too much, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and you got to realize sometimes these things happen on the court. I mean, you're not meaning to meander, but okay, he's attacking, he's cooking. Oh, you know what I mean?
And like, even to like, I love the way that you started this one, because like something that, you know, we've talked about on the pod quite a bit and like I've tweeted about or whatever. It's just like the relationship between shooting and spacing, like there is overlap, but there is not, it's not the same thing. Like you can have five shooters on the floor, and if you have two guys standing too close to each other and the defender can defend both because of how they're spending, like you have good shooting on the floor, you have bad spacing. Like, the spacing is more the relationship between like where these guys are and what kind of strain you can put on defenses, which is why you often see or have seen something as simple as our worst shooters in a strong side corner. Traditionally, teams don't help from there. And so we are still able to generate a level of spacing for this drive or this pick and roll or whatever because of where we're putting the bad shooter. And you've already gone through the examples of smaller guy in the dunker spot, et cetera. So I don't want to hang here too long. You've already nailed the answer. But I think it is just in general important to recognize like how defense, how offenses are trying to put strain on defenses. It can be five out if you have the appropriate spacing out there. But you mentioned Cleveland as an example. I think having bigs that understand, one, bigs that can finish, but two, bigs that can pass. And when talking about, you know, Jared Allen in the darker spot or short corner or whatever, if they put Evan Mobley in the corner, like understanding when to cut and like having that kind of sense for timing that thing out and staying in a ball handler's line of sight, you can really get creative with how you space around certain actions or just in general how you space. And to the small guy in the dunker spot specifically, like that feels like one of the louder examples of we can put strain on defenses in a different way. Like this is something that we talked about in the pod about Milwaukee with, you know, Drew Holiday was in the dunker spot. PJ Tucker was in the dunker spot. Like I'll never forget that Eastern Conference Finals. And you remember getting the report between like, what was it, game two and game three or somewhere middle of the series where PJ Tucker goes to the office with Mike Budenholzer like, hey, I want to be more involved. Like they're putting Trey on me. I can make an impact in some kind of way. And so like you got the token touches and he won on the offensive glass. But a lot of the winning on the offensive glass in the series for PJ was, hey, I'm going to be in the dunker spot versus like spacing in the corner and taking the corner threes, which we were accustomed to with seeing PJ in like Houston and stuff like that. So there are a lot of different ways you can get to straining defense. Like that's the name of the game. If it is five out, if it is having a guy on the wing or having a guy in the corner, then lifting up to the wing, like ultimately it doesn't have to be a static thing.
No, I like it. Great question. Was there a second question in there?
There is a... the second part. Does the current valorization of five out spacing mean that fans and media undervalue the skill set of catching and finishing around the rim on rolls and cuts and overvalue the ability to get to the rim and finish on drives?
I mean, I think if we're talking about something that's undervalued, it's probably the decision-making on the short roll. And if we're being honest, that ability to see where the help's coming from, see where the pass goes, and keep that advantage, I think that's really key for a big. I think that's something that as it's grown, you just kind of expect them to do. And sometimes you forget that's a skill that has to be developed at times to have that processing. So I think that's really important. I think it's more so just being able to read the pocket as well and understand when that roll is there, when I need to stop short, where's the tag, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So I think probably those two, I'd probably go to finishing on drives is important, but it's also knowing when to drive. You probably undervalue the skill set of catching and finishing and making decisions and finding cutters and those kind of things.
I got you. Like, I think cutter timing is probably a thing that's undervalued generally. I don't know. It feels like there's two schools of thought based on conversations I've seen throughout the last few years to where I think teams can or people can overvalue like certain players with the cutting and kind of undersells like, hey, there are legitimate shooting concerns here or like utility concerns here. And like cutting isn't going to erase literally all of it, that kind of thing. But I also don't think it's just easy to cut. Like, I don't think it's as easy as some people make it. Like, there is a timing, there is a rhythm, there is a feel to it, because you can't cut and take away driving opportunities, or your cut can now make it easier for a defender to defend two guys at the same time if you don't know when to do that. So I'd say like that aspect of it probably gets a little undervalued. I don't know if the catching and finishing around the rim portion, I don't know if that's undervalued, because I think with how much conversation we've collectively had about five out and going spread, pick and roll and stuff like that, I think we generally get the value of having like a legitimate lob threat. At least that's my read on it. So I don't think that portion is underrated. To your point, Steve, like the short roll part and the reads from that, I think people are still catching up on that front and how difficult that generally is. But I would say to the undervalued portion, I lean more towards the cutting portion, like when players decide to do that. But that is a really good question. Somewhat related to that, this one coming from Nash, who says, hello, been listening for 3 years now. Salute to you. As a Cavs fan, a lot was talked about Evan Mobley needing to develop a three-point shot to stretch defenses. What do you think is most important for bigs to try, for bigs trying to grow into the new era of basketball? A three-point shot or improve the ball handling?
Good question.
I don't know if you're going to like my answer, because it kind of depends on your context, your skill set, where you're at, who you're playing with. I think you need to have a level of versatility these days. So a three-point shot, fantastic, helps. You're going to have to be able to drive some closeouts in theory. You're going to be able to have to understand and handle the ball and get dribble handoffs going, know when to screen, know when to roll. If I had to choose between those two, I think you'd probably want to – I'd probably go ball handling. It's going to give you a little bit more versatility. It's going to give you a little bit more attack. I think the thing with Evan Mobley is his drives have been so important. So while the three-point shot is falling, you know, it took him time to kind of take those reps and get them up, and now he's seen the growth and improvement. But if he doesn't have the drives and the quick decision-making on top of that, I don't know if the package feels the same. I don't know if he lifts the Cavs to this degree because he's got that ability to do multiple things. Like, I think about Jaren Jackson Jr. It's cool when the threes go in. I like when he just backs someone down from the wing or attacks a closeout and says, I'm going to finish. I don't really care where you're at. Karl-Anthony Towns, his drives this year have been important to where – you know, we saw the growth as far as teams just wanted to put wings on him and he tried to hit the turbo button and then the wing would still be there. And now he's in an animation and now it's a little you know, he's delivering a little bit more of a blow on these drives this year.
Sure is.
So I would probably go with ball handling to be able to take advantage of some of the space and be able to attack some of the bigs that may be guarding you. So now that puts you in kind of a versatile aspect where if you can play five and four, you can kind of go at both sides of it. You can make a big guy come out and guard you and then drive past him. Like, that's another part of the Evan Mobley deal. Oh, yeah, yeah. We have to deal with him at the five. You know, now you can get some inverted pick and roll for yourself and put pressure on teams that way. So, as much as I love the three-point shot and I understand the value of it, this is not me going on an old man rant. Give me the drives.
No, I think that's fair. And honestly, that is also my answer. Like, I think improved ball handling, it just allows you to be used in different actions and ultimately allows you to access tighter quarters of the floor. Because I think for the three-point shot, like, it's been cool that Evan Mobley's been flirting around 40% for most of the year. The threshold to being treated as a legitimate three-point threat is pretty high, especially if you came in as, like, non-shooter. Like, Evan Mobley's never been a complete zero, but you get the general point that I'm making. Like, it wasn't like he came in as a guy that took like five threes a game at USC and you kind of have that just on the scouting report off rip. And so I think in light of that, even in a year where Evan Mobley shot well from three, it's not like he's get like every three-point attempt is a super hard closeout. We have to run him off the line, otherwise he's going to kill us. Like, he's not being defended like Cat. Like, his short rolls or his pops are not being defended like Karl-Anthony Towns, for an example. And so in light of that reality, if you're going to be given the gap anyway, like, to your point, Steve, like, I'd much rather have the big focus in on being able to flow into some of those quick hitting handoffs or just being able to attack a short close and then deliver blows on drives. I would lean towards the ball handling portion, because then even if you do space you again, you could just put you in the middle of the floor. We go into delay action, whatever. You can go to a handoff on either side, whatever the case may be. Like, I think it's more fruitful on that front. If you're starting from like a neutral spot, like, if you had already, like, if Evan Mobley took like four threes a game, and it's like, okay, this is fine, but he now has a bar to get to like elite, then I could understand leaning more into like, let's speed up the 3-point shooting process for him. But considering it wasn't that, like, I lean more towards the ball handling on that front. And with that, next question going to come from Visor or Visor. You have permission to yell at me if I messed that up. My apologies early on. Who says, hi, guys. I have been following the podcast since January 2023 with the extensive attention to the WNBA being a large factor to stay around with your podcast. It's an easy way to stay updated with WNBA or NBA content while living in Belgium and not being able to watch the games. I have some questions about the other Belgium, Toumani Camara, a late second round pick by the post Mikal Bridges Phoenix Suns. I thought he could get some good minutes as a defender, but he was traded to Portland as part of the Ayton trade. Number one, as we have a round of questions on Toumani Camara, he is offensively limited to spacing the floor with shooting threes in the corner or well-timed cuts. Are there other offensive tools that need to become part of his game, or is it just a case of doing those things more efficiently?
One good question. Two, happy 2 years. Three, I probably would just say it's more the context. You got a lot of guards there. You got a lot of people who can make plays. Like, we've seen Anthony Simons, we've seen Shaedon Sharpe, we've seen Denny do more of the playmaking. So it's more, okay, what is he looking at? How is he attacking? So when he gets a handoff, is he just getting an under? If he's just getting an under and the defense isn't moving, okay, is he turning the corner and finishing? Is it a rescreen scenario, or is he getting off the ball? I think it gets tricky there. I think probably mixing in some more cuts, trying to attack and transition and run there. Obviously, you want to continue to work on and knock down the corner threes. That'll help add to it. But it's more so just kind of figuring your lane out to where you can contribute. Like, sometimes, you know, we've seen them use him as a screener. So mixing that in can help. But I probably would just say it's more mindset attack to me. You know, we've seen him have some big offensive nights where the shot's going. So now, I'm taking pull-ups. I'm here. I'm ready for you. We've also seen nights where it gets kind of quiet. So it's just, what's the point or the trigger point for him? So I'd probably like to see some of the drives improve from the perimeter to where, okay, yeah, you're playing off me, but now I'm going to go ahead and meet you in your body, bump, try and get a finish, or I get to drive and kick. So it's not so reliant on just, okay, I've made a bunch of threes.
Yeah.
But I didn't mean to cut you off, but like, then that also goes back to the context of, okay, how much of his openness is because Portland's bending something, or how much of it is, hey, we're just leaving you type beat. So,
well, I think that's fair. I was trying to look up what the actual drive numbers were for him so far this year. So that's why I was looking off screen there. But the drives are going to be the big thing for me. And just, I guess, drive / intermediate area stuff. Like, to the point of the question, like, yeah, you would want the three ball to get more consistent, since he is primarily going to be used as a spacer. Like, I think he is a good and smart cutter overall. So, like, refinement there is key. If we're just talking about adding something, I want to feel better about him as a driver overall. Because something that's popped for me on film this year, like, he is hitting folks on these drives. Like, he does have a real intention to get all the way into the paint. I don't think that always bodes well for him once he gets super deep in the paint. Like, just working on the craft around the basket, especially when he's trying to deal with size at the rim. As he's not an A++ athlete, like, that kind of stands out. And then to that point, if you're dealing with unders, you get rescreens, you know, the few times they do let him run a pick and roll or a handoff. If you can't get all the way to the rim, what are you going to do? Like, I wish he had like a short pull up that he felt comfortable taking with some sort of regularity. Now, he doesn't need to turn himself into like DeMar DeRozan, but just as a counter to the deep, powerful drives. Does he have a pull-up that he feels comfortable with? Does he have a floater that he feels comfortable with? Like, I think that's probably what I would want him to focus on to really take the next step as a complementary offensive piece. Because, again, like, he's not going to be a primary guy. But the more counter punches you have, the more valuable you are off the ball. Steve, you already mentioned he's used as a screener sometimes in Portland. So if he could be used as a screener, if he has good sense as a cutter, he's going to have the corner threes there. He's comfortable. Like, he's not scared to attack a closeout. It's just more so refinement on that front. I think getting something in the intermediate area so he could do something comfortably at all three levels, I think, is where I would go with Tumani. And as far as the drive stat that I just pulled up via Second Spectrum, as of recording, 142 players have logged at least 200 drives so far this season. And in terms of points per possession on those drives, Tumani Kamara is 128th. In that group, 0.89 points per possession on any featuring a Tumani Kamara drive. And to Steve's point, like, some of that is just context. And obviously you go through the film on some of those. Some of those are just fruitful drives that are just, you know, shots that he normally makes, he doesn't make. Or smart drive, quick attack off of a closeout, makes a kick to someone, they miss a three. That counts as a zero on the points per possession thing. So it doesn't mean he's completely awful at it, but that is where he ranks so far. And so, for his own benefit, again, some kind of comfort in the intermediate areas, something that I would look at. Then just refinement in terms of the craft, trying to finish over taller players in the paint.
Sounds like he need a mid-range.
Yeah, it would be a little helpful. Again, it doesn't have to completely, like, shape the shot profile, but counterpunch would be nice. We'll put it there. As for the second Tumani Kamara question, are there big defensive working points that you guys have seen he needs to improve at to make that next step? Or is it just improving in small steps, like not making fouls in certain situations, navigating screens a bit better?
You can mix in number three with this one, too. We can just answer all that in one pile.
Okay. All right. Third question. Is he actually a good defender, or is he an average defender on a bad defensive team, which makes him look better?
He's a very good defender. Mm. The Portland Trailblazers, I asked that man to guard Nikola Jokic on purpose, on top of some of the other matchups that we've seen where he's got to guard Zion Williamson and try and figure out how to navigate. He's got a versatility that you can't really teach. I think the activity stands out for himself, the work that he's done off ball, on ball to navigate screens. But you got to look at the variety of players he's been asked to guard, either matchup wise or in switches, to where, you know, he's guarding Damian Lillard. He's guarding Chris Middleton in the post, making it tough. He's guarding Zion, Jokic. Like, he just is kind of the person that they ask to do these things. Now, does it mean he's automatically going to be all-world defender every single night? No. So I think it's more of a consistency. I think you want to continue the activity, but also understand when to use it, how to use it to your advantage. When am I pressuring? Am I putting myself in a good position on ball? At times off ball, how locked in am I? So it's not necessarily like he's a bad defender, but to take those next steps to become, you know, truly elite, that's probably what you're looking at, in my opinion.
I got you. I think we're tying these two in. So I guess answering number three first, I do think he's actually a good defender. And to add to the matchup versatility that you mentioned, Steve, Tomani Kamara not only leads the NBA in charges taken at 24, he has the lead by 7 charges. That's not how that's supposed to work. And so that activity, the rotations, like, he will take some bumps. Like you already mentioned, him having to defend different 4s and 5s. So he has to bang with bigger and stronger players on top of that. But there's a willingness to defend that I really enjoy for him. Like, I think to get to number two, I think it is more refinement for him more than like trying to add something to a particular package. Like, I would point to, I guess, less the screen navigation and more to like the recovery path for him once he gets hit. But I also give him a little bit of grace because you mentioned him defending big sometimes. Like, they'll also just toss him on guards. And I'm just like, I don't know if that's where he's best utilized. Like, he feels better 3 through 5 than he does like 1 through 3, at least to me. And then you factor in the rest of the Portland context. Though, to their credit, you know, we talked about this recently on the pod, like, the defense has perked up as of late. But just as a general note, it's not like he is surrounded by like OKC's cast to where you can just turn this into a switch all if he does get beaten, it's okay. He hasn't always had that. And so, like, I guess more so recovery path when he gets hit. And so if they are in the super deep drop that they've had with Donovan Kling and stuff like that, if he gets beat, being more consistent with making that beeline to the big to turn it into a late switch if that's what they want to do, or just to get into that area of the pocket. So if they try to make that late pocket pass, he can still get deflections. Like, he's got a few of those this year, but like being more consistent on that kind of thing, I guess, would be something that I would point to. But no, I do think he is a very good defender. He's been asked a ton this year because of some of the stuff around him. So I would love to see him in a better defensive context. Maybe you see some of these other things pop more when he isn't tasked with being the guy defensively, but I do think he's very good.
To add to it, probably weak side defense is where I'd like to see some improvement. Not that it's bad, but there are moments where he just kind of is in his help spot, but also doesn't see the next play that's coming. Mm-hmm. So it's, oh no, and try and get a block, something like that. So yeah, I'd add that to the mix. Good stuff.
We like it. Also, the PS at the end of the question. To Steve, I swear I'm not a Nikias burner account. I'm a real person. At least you gave him a shout on the all defensive team before Nikias did. Which,
considering Nikias wasn't sure about pronouncing the name, I do not believe you.
That's crazy. First and foremost. Second, I get this bar off since January 2023. Let the record show that literally last season, as I revealed my extremely long all defense list of candidates, Tomani Kamara was on my list of players last year. So in a literal sense, I have been the first to mention Tomani Kamara in an all defense context on this year's podcast. But who is keeping count?
Apparently. What kind of disgusting display is that? You made 78 lists, and yeah, you didn't. I didn't hear you say his name earlier this year.
That wasn't his fault.
You put 19 Thunder on there.
19 Now that's not. Hold on. We pulled the notes right now. We go. Hold on. You can press pause on the pod right now.
Are you actively looking this up as if you actually put 19 Thunder on there? As if I got to do a higher number to exaggerate it?
No, I'm curious to see how many Thunder I actually had on here. Funny enough, no. How I'm looking at this, Tubani is on my list this year too.
Where?
You know what? That's okay. You said what? Yeah.
Nothing. It's fine. What's the next question?
Okay. He's one of the forwards I have on the list. Anyway, next one's going to come from our dear pal Zoe or Zoe, who says, "Hi, hello. This is my first ever mailbag question. I've recently been getting into watching the PWHL, and they have a very interesting draft lottery system where the draft order is determined by the amount of points earned after the team is eliminated from playoff contention. In hockey, teams earn 3 points for a regulation win, 2 points for an overtime win, 1 for an overtime loss, and 0 for a regulation loss. While in FIBA basketball rules, the standard is 2 points for any win, 1 point for any loss. You could go with either. Would you like to see this implemented in the W and or the MNBA? While I fully acknowledge that players wouldn't have much of a reason to care about this, I think it could be really exciting for fans of bad teams, as it would, in theory, get rid of the incentive to fully tank out. Imagine the healed-up Pelicans rallying around Zion towards a win streak in March, despite not having a chance to make the playoffs. Will Hardy using his dark magic to conjure the annual Jazz run. LaMelo and Brandon Miller hooping their hearts out in hopes of getting any resemblance of help next season, or maybe even a front office making, or not making, a move in pursuit of the first pick. It would mean the fans and front offices have a reason to care about those now meaningless games, and it should be easy to market with a lottery table that fans could track. The good teams that end up just missing out on the playoffs wouldn't have time to earn enough points to get a high pick, so the hierarchy of the lottery would be maintained. Thanks for everything you guys do. Shout out to everyone in the watch parties, and shout out to the Hawks.
This is right up your alley, so I'm going to go quick. I think it's fun. I think it's fantastic. I mean, Cam Johnson told every single fan, oh, you don't really like us like that. I don't want to hear about that tanking, dog. We're trying to win. So I think the winning element is still there. I think I personally would just, as much as I love immersion and a good table and getting into it, I would point to the play-in. Because when are you truly eliminated? Like, we got a few teams right now. I'm not going to name any names, but you know who you are. But then is that a disadvantage for like the Portlands of the world who aren't there but ain't there? You know,
like, when are we eliminated?
Yeah. Like do the Bulls just get one shot at it? Like, you know what I mean? Man, do we end up in the same place?
That's fair. You mentioned the Bulls.
What? What's wrong? What's wrong with the Bulls? This is what you wanted. This is what you asked for. You didn't appreciate the Bulls there, and this is what you get. I tried to tell you what the team was, and you're like, man, it's bad. Blow it up. Hey, man, it's bad. Get rid of it. Do something else. They did something else.
Yeah, thank goodness for that. Voot should be a warrior, but that's okay. But no, it's... I guess it's less Chicago. Well... No, it's a little bit of Chicago. Just the way that they've handled the last 3-4 years is kind of funny. So, like, thinking through what this format would look like for them specifically is kind of funny. As for the actual idea, though, like, I kind of like it. I'm not going to hold you. Like, I think my question would be, and, you know, Zoe hit on this in the question, just, like, what would the player engagement be like? So I guess, like, on one hand, it probably wouldn't change as much for them. Because that's Cam Johnson and other that's where I want to pause. Can we stop asking players about tanking? Can I just make a very quick media plea on that front? It's felt like 8 straight years of good player on obvious bad team and a variation of, hey, the fans were really upset when y'all won. What you think about that? And every single player in existence telling you, well, we want to compete. We always want to win. We're not playing for draft picks and draft positioning. Can we just remove that question from the lexicon? We don't have to do this every year. I think in 2025, we should all have the general understanding that tanking, or whatever you want to call it, is very much a front office slash forward thinking idea that the players on the actual roster who may end up being traded or replaced or, you know, demoted into rotation based on where this pick is going to land, they're not playing for that. They're never going to play for that. They're never going to subscribe to that. These are competitive, talented players that want to make millions of dollars on top of winning games. They're never going to be like, yep, I get it. I don't get the value in asking players about this.
Yeah, man, get that out of the hexagon.
Like, we don't have to do this every year. Like, it's again, like, my problem is with the question. Like, I don't have, like, any reporter beef or anything like that. So, you know, I don't think anybody's thinking that. But I'll throw the disclaimer out there just in case it's necessary. But, like, we don't have to do that every year. We know the answer. We know. Players don't want to tank. Coaches don't want to tank. If you're going to ask tanking-related questions, it needs to be directed to general manager or team owner or whatever. That's where you're going to get your good stuff. That's where you're going to get any semblance of honesty if you're going to get it. You're not going to get it from the players. And you shouldn't. It would be problematic if you did. We ain't got to do that. We ain't got to do that. My apologies for hijacking that.
Do you feel better now?
A little bit. I didn't think that was it. Back a little looser, you know what I mean? I didn't think I needed that, but I guess I needed that. But to the question, I do kind of like the idea. Like, I think that'd be neat. It'd be another branding opportunity for the NBA. And so, you know, if you're going to have some of the teams that have fallen out of the immediate playoff picture still scheduled for national TV games, like, you have another access point to kind of do that. With,
Sketching for what?
So, you know, there are some avenues there. I do think flex. That'd be cool. No flex.
No way.
Oh. Ah. All right. Anyway. Next question coming from Tony says, in my previous mailbags, I've tended to ask questions about X's and O's or team strategies. DHO sets, grinding tape, roster composition and strategy. Real sicko stuff. But I'm going to switch it up with this one and ask a broader NBA landscape question. I try not to engage in.
Oh, I'm scared.
I'm thinking about the sheer weight and energy around this Luka for AD trade. People who I never talked to about basketball are asking me about it. My wife asked me about it, which is groundbreaking. So here's my question slash concern. There has been much discourse around NBA viewership of late, and the league has invested and innovated with the NBA Cup and changing up the All-Star game to attempt to capture people's attention. Related to this, there's no question that this Luka deal in particular has dominated the sport's eyeball economy for this news cycle. To what extent do you all feel that the NBA could learn the wrong lesson here and possibly continue to craft the dynamic in such a way so as to drive more of these kinds of mega deals that draw this much attention to the league? I understand this is full-blown conspiracy nut job stuff. And no, I don't think Silver and the NBA engineered this Luka deal for eyeballs. I want to believe that this is a one-off case and unprecedented in such a way that it won't become a trend. Indeed, I'd question how the league would even try to manufacture these types of deals moving forward. But in broad terms, I could see a future where deals like these could become more common, and that concerns me. Let's not forget that a portion of this Luka deal was the price tag on Luka's Supermax. I don't think the NBA intended for the Supermax to have that kind of impact, but here we are. Fully expecting Steve to tell me that I'm crazy, and that would be good news to me.
Shout out to his family. Salute, Tony. Crazy. No, I'm joking. I just did that for the bit. So here's the thing with this question. I appreciate it. I don't necessarily know if you could go full booking trades because of the moving pieces involved. Now, I don't think we're going to see many more of these because of the reaction from the Dallas Mavericks fan base. And I just don't know how many GMs are going to be willing to make that kind of move in the near future. Now, they're going to have to. Some trades are going to have to be done. People love to talk about trades, and they love the rumor season and all that stuff. I get it. But I don't necessarily think this is going to be the bit where it's just going to be, I mean, you're going to have teams that go for something. Doesn't work. We move on, or star wants out. I think that's always going to be there to a degree. But I don't think it's going to be this. That's the reason the reaction was what it was, because no one expected this. And this is supposed to, how it's supposed to work. Yeah, I mean, like, what? How would you even make it work? Like, how many players can you really put together? Like, you know, is the league going to create another Phoenix Suns? I don't believe that. Like, let's send Jokic and Giannis to the Knicks. Okay, who else is there? They have no money left. You know, you just kind of book yourself in the corner. I don't think they'll do that.
Okay. Can I ask a related free throw question?
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how to frame this, because it's like it's somewhat respectfully messy, but not all the way. Because as you mentioned, like, could you create another Phoenix Suns? I think creating another Phoenix Suns kind of template would involve like the no trade clause of it all. And so I'm trying to think of like which player in like the Beal tier could get a no trade clause. Like, who would be the next Beal in this iteration?
I have a dangerous question. Who's in the Beal tier?
Well, that depends on who you ask. I mean, you're asking me. I think Bradley Beal is still pretty good. And like we talked about in the BR stream, like all the conversation around Beal and this no trade clause and everything else, it's like he has scored very efficiently this year, at the very least. But I'm just like trying to think of, cause even thinking about back to like Washington Beal, like it didn't even have to be this version, but like really good player on team that's kind of toiling away, but has such like an organization would invest in that player in that kind of way. I'm just trying to think of like who would like, would it be like, I'm trying to make like the Washington Beal to like 2025 parallel, which is making it tough in my head in real time. Like, I think he's better than Beal was at this point, but would it be like the Kings giving like Sabonis a no trade clause on his next deal?
No comment.
I'm like, I'm trying to think of like, obviously he wasn't drafted by Sacramento, but like that trade got them the first playoff appearance since X year and all this different stuff. And like, he's now been the mainstay since De'Aaron Fox is gone. And so I'm trying to think like, would he be the example of like fringe all NBA talent with obvious ties to the organization that could ask for it? I'm thinking Sabonis. I feel like Zach LaVine probably would have been the easier one if he wasn't literally just traded to Sacramento. Like LaVine in Chicago might have got there. Like LaMelo in Charlotte? Question mark? Would that count? I'm intrigued by this now.
Clearly.
Huh. Like those would probably be the names. But at any rate, back to the actual question, as I just hijacked that for, you know, so my apologies there. I don't think I'd be super worried. Like the only worry I would have with the broader context of the question is that because the Luka deal happened, I think that at least partially influenced like that we got to move Kevin Durant because we can't move Beal. And like, that would have been another superstar domino to fall. And so, like, if it does become, like, a heightened arms race, too, we have to do whatever we can to get the next superstar, not just next all-star that comes available. Like, does that get kind of funny on that front? Like, I would keep an eye on it, but ultimately, like, I don't think the league's in real danger for, like, three or four more of those kind of seismic deals. So I won't go quite to you're crazy, but, like, I wouldn't super worry about it, I guess I put it that way. But all right, let's get to the final three questions that we have. This one coming from Grant. What are the Lakers' chances coming out of the West? How do they match up with Denver and OKC?
TBD.
I do love the concept. Like, hey, let's just make this a 20-second answer and get to the next question. But like, I think I would probably put the Lakers in dark horse territory in the West. Like, they're a top five seed in the West right now. So it's not like they're a bad team. But I will say, like, I do feel like OKC is kind of in a tier of their own in the West right now. The Lakers become more interesting against OKC just because they have now two big forward playmakers that can kind of poke at some of the lack of, like, guard/wing size that OKC has. like obviously Lu Dort, elite defender, Alex Caruso, elite defender, Cason Wallace, very good, if not elite defender, Shea, really good defender, et cetera. But like they still don't have the like hulking 6'8", 6'9", big four that can take those dudes. And so like a LeBron fully engaged in playoff mode, I would pick the Thunder to win a series like pre-Luka trade. But like LeBron could pose very specific problems in a playoff setting because of that kind of archetype. And so now that you're tossing LeBron and Luka on top of this, I can see that being dicier for OKC's defense. Like, ultimately, I don't think the Lakers have enough horses defensively to really deal with OKC to, like, beat them or for me to feel comfortable picking them. I wouldn't rule out an upset, but, like, I wouldn't feel comfortable picking the Lakers in a series yet. But I do think having the talent of Luka and LeBron in his own right, but the fact that they are both 6'7", 6'8", bulky dudes that OKC doesn't have a great archetype for defensively, I think that makes it closer. As for Denver, like, God bless Alex Lynn, but, like, they just don't have a Jokic guy. Like, nobody really has a Jokic guy, but they really don't have a Jokic guy right now. And, like, they don't even have the put size on, they'll put a forward on Jokic and then have Anthony Davis roam over. Like, they can't even fully replicate that portion of the program now. And so while the Lakers, again, have Luka and LeBron that can poke at Denver's defense, especially if they're going to have, like, Jokic at the level and stuff like that, I wouldn't doubt that L.A. could score on Denver at a high level. But Jokic is so game-breaking in and of itself, and now you're adding in the fact that the Lakers just do not have a starter-quality center on the roster right now, with all due respect to Alex Lynn and Jackson Hayes. I don't quite know how the Lakers get there. Like, this feels like the Lakers making some kind of deal in the offseason, whether it's a trade or finding someone on the minimum, or, like, I don't know what kind of wizardry they'd have to knock out to get underneath the second apron, unlock, like, a mid-level exception or something. But, like, I think they're going to have to add someone to the front court room to really make the Denver thing match up more favorable for them. Because, like, I just don't think they have the horses defensively to pull that off yet. But Lakers Thunder is intriguing. I can't quite get to some other folks, the way that some other folks have talked about a potential Lakers Thunder series without at all acknowledging how good OKC's been all year, but that's a whole nother thing. But Luka and LeBron could put very specific amounts of pressure on that OKC defense. And I think they would really have to lock in to kind of force the amount of turnovers that they need to kind of thwart the impact that they could have. And I think that would be, that's probably a Thunder in six, but it's a Thunder in a close six, that they don't win any game by double digits type beat.
I see. I understand it now.
Aha. Steve, your thoughts? You said TBD. I guess that's just it. I didn't know if that was the joke answer or the real answer.
I think for me, it's just mostly I need to see what it looks like at first. I know that's boring, but I need to see what Denver tries to attack. Does small ball work against Jokic to any sort of degree? Does Luka impact how they guard? Do they have another person they attack? How do these teams try to attack Luka? What does that look like? So I think they have elevated their chances because you're going to have to deal with Luka and LeBron in the playoff context. That's not easy. But I need to see what the defense looks like, what the rotations look like, how they measure up against top teams. And I've only seen two games against the Utah Jazz. So
Understood. 1-1 in those games. So there you go. Next question going to come from Tarun, who says, "Dear Nikias and Steve, a day one listener, shout out to you, but first time emailer. Love the show. Thanks for all the amazing content and insight. I appreciate you covering both leagues. It's really informed my fandom. I've been a Connecticut Sun fan since getting into the W 5 years ago. I'm from Boston, so they're my geographically closest team, and I've loved watching them over the years. Yeah, we weren't good enough to win the chip, but we pushed every team and competed with insane defense and hustle. Two finals in 5 years is nothing to be mad at. Many teams would trade their luck for that. I love going to games at Mohegan Sun and was looking forward to more future games in my local TD Garden. I've implored many friends to get into the league and team because of how enjoyable to watch they are. But man, this winter, losing JJ was already tough, Jonquel Jones. Was already tough 2 years ago, but watching the entire starting lineup and coach Stephanie White walk with no clear plan in sight has me down bad. That combined with Alyssa Thomas's comments on sharing a practice court with a kid's birthday party has me questioning my loyalty. I knew we'd need to retool. The offense wasn't at the level, but losing DeJounte Carrington in particular has me really upset. are we really going full rebuild without draft picks? Are we ever going to invest truly in making a legit title push? I've lost faith in the ownership actually caring about a title and not just making some profit on top of the casino money. I feel like I'm in a bad relationship where neither wants to end it, but the other partner is acting worse and worse to force me to dump them. Do you have any optimism in the Suns' future, or should I start being team polyamorous?
Put the phone down. Charge it. Don't send no texts. Put the phone down. Put it away. It's time to have a conversation with this person. And just slow down. Slow down. Remember the good times. Now, here's the thing. Here's the thing. These things happen, and there wasn't much you could do about it. Mm-hmm. A very, very specific circumstance took place where everyone left. Again, we've seen this happen to teams. You build it up. You make a push. I mean, the Sky are still going through it. It's all about how you recover. But this is a team that for the last four seasons has gone to the semifinals. They've won 25 or more games for four straight years. How much more could you add to that core? You know, they swung for the fences to get Marina Mabry to try and make one last push with the group, and it didn't work, and you kind of had to pivot, especially in a league where this is 1 year. Everything changes next year, supposedly. Okay, we want to try different things. I think you have to take a look and understand this year may not be as fun as what you're used to, but you're going to be competitive and annoying. You got a new coach. You do have Natasha Cloud. You got Tina Charles hitting people. You have you got a Marina Mabry trade, allegedly. You got J.C. Sheldon, who is active and will defend. So I think this group can get you back. It's just going to look a little different. It's just going to feel a little different. The winning might not be as plentiful as you're used to. But that doesn't mean the product can't be good and the team can't work hard and, prove what their potential is. Because here's the thing. You do have to build something, which is why they didn't trade Natasha Cloud, allegedly, in that rumor. We got to have something. Because everybody keeps saying this facilities word, and I don't like it. So I think you give them a chance. See what the offense looks like. See if the defensive level is there. See if there's a little bit of sneaky value of a team that no one really expects to be good, Fall for the pump fake real quick. Give it some time. Go to therapy. Work it out.
Hoo-wee. Okay, so I think that is a fair stance to have, first and foremost. Related to this, though, I will say it is a little funny that in an email question saying, hey, all these people left, do I need to stay here? Part of your pitch for the roster is, hey, somebody else gonna get traded. I just find that personally funny. Even if you are correct, that we will likely see a Marina maybe trade at some point. And I know the general point is like whatever they get for her, and it could be good stuff. But I got a nice internal chuckle at that being the reality for Connecticut. As far as optimism for the Sun, like broader sense, like I probably lean no right now. Just because of how much change is happening in the league and because you lost. It'd be one thing if you just lost like Bree Jones and you got one last hurrah at this iteration of the roster and then everyone kind of met their own separate ways. You kind of rebuild as everything's happening. Like to lose everyone at once heading into, the 2026 offseason where pretty much everyone's going to be a free agent with the new CBA, et cetera, TV deal, TV money kicking in, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just like, what exactly are you selling? Like it's a tough, like this happened to them at the wrong time. I feel like this is the worst possible year that they could have had this amount of absences and these specific absences or, departures, excuse me, to happen all at once. So like you know, far be it for me to say, like, hey, for anyone to just lose their fandom outside of, like, legit problematic things happening. Like, in those cases, like, no, rip up the jerseys, whatever. And, like, mourn that, but whatever. This is unfortunate, so I'm not going to flat out say, like, nah, just leave them, root for somebody else. I will say to the literal wording of the question, like, do I have optimism for the Suns' future? Like, I don't right now. Like, I have pieces that I like, but as far as them getting to championship contention soon, I personally do not see that right now. Like, I would need to see a lot of things happen over the next year or so for me to get back on that train. They just have a really difficult path.
Nakata said no.
I'm big on
that man said cheat on Valentine's Day. That's, well, crazy.
No, that is not what I said. That is not even close to what I said. The question
was this, should I be team polyamorous? And you said yeah.
No. Do you have any optimism in the Suns' future? My answer was no. Now, to the second part, I said I'm not telling you to just leave. If nothing else, like, be single, you know what I mean? Just stay by yourself. Like, I ain't saying if we get into that part of the question, you know, work on, you know, focus on yourself would be my answer. I ain't gonna say, you know, let's go root for six different teams, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's not gonna be my answer.
Focus on yourself.
Hey, listen, I'm trying to answer as best as I can. But you know, I will be rooting for Ono, though. I will sprinkle that in. I do think she's very good. I think she's going to be an early contender for most improved player. But it's just kind of tough. And I think just in general, with as we continue to get names upon names upon names of teams building investment groups to bring franchises and stuff, if the Sun want to be serious in this thing moving forward, they have to invest in more amenities and facilities for their players. They just have to. Like, that's just a non-negotiable. They have to. And I hope they do, because they do have a tremendous fan base. The people there love the team. And I think the investment dollars need to match how much the fans care. And I will leave it there. Final question going to come from Eric, who says, Nafisa Collier is distantly the MVP choice so far, but who would you have on your first and second team all unrivaled teams? And secondarily, should Azaree Stevens be included despite her relatively low minute count? She's currently third in unrivaled in points per minute and fourth in rebounds per minute. And I'll also quickly salute Eric. I didn't include it into like the actual doc. But Eric, as is our pal, Zoe from earlier in the mailbag, tracking some advanced stats for Unrivaled since they're not officially on the site. So we got some.
It's three on three basketball.
we got some offensive rating stuff, some defensive rating stuff, some pace stuff. Eric notes that he does pace like based on the first three quarters because of the untimed measure of the fourth quarter. So it's like pace per like 21 minutes, stuff like that. But like there, some tracking's being done. So shout out to Zoe, shout out to Eric on that front. But two of the questions. Steve, who would be your all unrivaled first and second teams?
Man.
That brother is upset.
Nafisa Collier.
Okay.
Kayla McBride.
Mm-hmm.
De'Erica Hamby.
Okay.
Sabrina Ionescu.
Okay.
Brittany Griner.
Okay.
Tiff Hayes.
Okay. So this is starting the second team. Okay, Tiff Hayes, second team.
Skylar Diggins-Smith.
Uh-huh.
Did I say Ryan Howard already?
You have not.
Rekia Jackson.
Okay.
Stephanie Dolson.
Okay. One, you are an absolute hooligan. Two, how dare you build out an unrivaled first and second team and not include Alicia Gray?
Because I knew you were going to.
That is...
And you didn't let me list the top 10 scores.
Come on, man. Oh, you gosh darn hooligan. Okay, so setting Steve's hooliganism aside, in typical Nikias fashion, I spent way too much time on this, and I was trying to sort through like what the actual format of the unrivaled teams would be. Right.
Oh, Lord. What did you
do? And I was just like, are we going to go like two guards, two forwards, and a center?
Positionless.
Is it going to be positionless? And then, like, you know, to the former point, it's like, ooh, it's 3-on-3. So is it just like, is it guard, forward, center? Is it guard, forward, forward? You know, because like Stewie's been starting as the nominal center for the Mets, but like she ain't really a five, but she played a five sometimes. I guess she would technically be the five here, but she ain't a five in the W, though they do a little bit sometimes. And I was doing a whole thing. And with the positionless portion, I was like, well, that doesn't feel like great to me, but I guess that is where everything's trending, et cetera. So what I have right now is like, essentially two back court, three front court is where I landed. I found the middle ground, like not quite positionless, but not quite like two guards, two forwards in the center. and so my first team, I have Kayla McBride and Alicia Gray in the back court. My three front court players, De'Erica Hamby, Nafisa Collier, who I think is, you know, the front, if there is going to be like actual unrivaled awards, I'm not sure as of right now, I have to send an email and ask, but Fee would be the MVP. And Brittany Griner would round out the first team, though I don't think the Brittany Griner selection is like set in stone for me. But she has been very good offensively at the very least. So Brittany Griner on the first team for me. Second team, I have Tiffany Hayes, I have Skylar Diggins-Smith, I have Kalia Copper, I have Angel Reese, and I have Breonna Stewart wrapping up the second team.
What's your first team again?
Kayla McBride, Alicia Gray, De'Erica Hamby, Nafisa Collier, Brittany Griner.
Okay.
So those would be my 10. But Ryan, like Chelsea Gray was a tough omission. Ryan Howard has played well. Like I think Alyssa Thomas would just flat out be on the team. Probably on the first team, frankly. But she's only played three games. So like that kind of gets shaky. The Azaree Stevens point was a good one. Like a bit of a slow start to the season for her, but she has been cooking. As a scorer, she's had to close out some games because of foul trouble. So she's played well. I couldn't quite get to like all unrivaled. However, Rekia Jackson was a good shout. Those are probably like my immediate like short list if there was a third team type players. Like Sabrina's been good. Like she's only played five games. So like the absences gets kind of funny on that front. But even with that, like that's one fewer game than Tiffany Hayes. And like now Tiffany Hayes is hurt. So like that will shift. Those would be like my early names as I begin to put this together.
Man.
What's up?
All these advanced stats, man. Brother Nikias, you tell me who else in Unrivaled is averaging 17.6 rebounds and 5 assists?
Let's pull up the plan. Hold on. 17, 6, and 5. Is that what you said?
Yep.
She's probably the only one if I had to guess.
Distant third team, man. Hit the horns.
Distant. Okay. I'm not doing this with you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter/BlueSky at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve, the birthday boy on Monday at Steve Jones 20. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties if you haven't already. The link is in the description. Free to create a profile, no shenanigans. You can come watch hoops with us or second screen with us. We play some video games and stuff too. We put up random YouTube videos. Steve had a playlist going for us to close out the watch party last night. I will leave it there. But it's a fun time, fun vibe. Come rock with some cool people if you'd like. But with that, enjoy your weekend and we will catch y'all later.
Nikias don't rock with Sabrina Carpenter.